91.3 0723 80712 is our WhatsApp number. Feel free to query, comment, or criticize. Free Book Friday, we haven't done one for some time. But in my hand, I have a book entitled The House of Chacho: Power Politics and Chiefs Northwest of the Great Kai River, circa 1818 to 2018. Now, this is one hell of a story, let's put it that way, because it deals with an era of our history that appears to have been airbrushed, or a people also being wished away by the colonial authorities. Let me give you some background before I introduce the author, or one of the authors. In 1852, Sir George Cathcart pronounced that the Amachacho chieftaincy no longer existed. "I have broken and banished the tribe," he boasted. And to fast forward to 2013, the Chacho chieftaincy was finally restored and its new incumbent installed in a powerful ceremony. But, as this author says, with history weighing so heavily on this story, it seems unlikely that this is the final chapter. This particular book was written by Professor Anne Kelk-Mager, who is online, Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Cape Town, and also by Pico Geoffrey Valelo, an agricultural economist, Anglican priest, and chief's counselor. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Shafiq.
And of course, the book has been published by UCT Press. Tell us something about this book in the sense that it's co-authored. But what is really striking is that you have a dialogue with your co-author at the beginning of the book. Tell us, why was this done?
The issue of co-authoring is a complex one. It is a risk to write with somebody. It's complicated in the sense that one needs to agree, one needs to get onto the same page, one needs to divide up tasks, one needs to understand and trust each other. It's a risky business in general. And when one of the authors is white and has grown up on the land from which the Amachacho were dispossessed, and the other is a counselor to the current chief of the Amachacho, we are positioned very differently in relation to that history. And so we needed to find each other. We needed to develop some platform, if you like, that we could use as a springboard from which to work. And to build a solid platform, we had to bear the truths that might be uncomfortable just sitting together and chatting. We got on, we liked each other, but we had to ask each other some very hard questions. So we made it formal. We put a tape recorder in front of us and asked each other tough questions, questions that were uncomfortable, questions that exposed the discomforts of this history. And there's a great deal of discomfort in this history.
Indeed there is, and I think it's quite brave. I've never seen anything like this before, actually, where you openly reveal the unease of that kind of dialogue and the whole process of trying to find, I suppose, a middle road. What was the decision to actually sort of put it out there?
Well, the part of the history of the writing of this book was that I had started work in the archives on the 19th century. Now, that didn't involve talking to people so much as sitting in the archives and digging up the sources. And I thought I would leave it there. I thought I would write two journal articles on the 19th century. And then there was a court case involving the right-hand House of Chacho, where they were going to court in a bid to have their own chief recognized as the legitimate chief in an area where Brigadier Charles Sebe of the Siskai had appointed his brother-in-law. And so there was a court case, and I thought I would go along to the court case. So with the chief's permission, I went along to the court case. And there I met Jeff Valelo, Pico Valelo. And I said, "Pico, could I have a chat with you after the court hearing is over, because this is a complicated story and I need to wrap my head around it. So we met at Pico's home in Bishoum, and he had sitting on the coffee table a mountain of research that he had gathered for this case. Literally a mountain, sort of six, right, 10 inches high. And he pushed it across the table and he said, "You can have it." Wow. And I said, "Oh no, Jeff, I can't have it. I either don't have it or I have the whole package." So that's when we said, "Okay, let's see if this can work." So we, the next meeting we had, and that was the second time I'd seen him. The first time was when he chaired the installation ceremony for Jongulundi in 2013. So I'd seen him on a platform, and then I saw him at the court, and then he came to Cape Town from Mpumalanga, where he works, so that we could meet and talk about the possibility of collaborating. So, as with everything in this book, it's a process. It's a process, and it's an ongoing process, and it's a process with jagged edges. There's no smooth set of relationships here, because everyone is positioned differently in relation to power, in relation to the past, in relation to the state, in factions, in Bantustan politics, and so on and so on.
No, it certainly is interesting. In the House of Chachu, when I first saw the title, I tried to read up on history, but I'd never heard of this, and it's my fault that I'd never heard of this. It's almost as if a whole group of people, I think you use the word ethnocide in the book, were just simply, at the stroke of a bureaucratic pen, just written out of history, just like that.
Yes. Well, in fact, we contest the idea of ethnocide, because that comes from the legal definition linked to genocide, and it's a deliberate attempt to wipe out people and culture. Now, George Cathcart wanted to obliterate the Amachachu, not so much physically, but politically, by scattering them. So it's a political process, a little different from a cultural process. And of course, I had never heard of the Amachachu. I found them in the archives. I'd heard of Chief Mapasa, but I had never heard of the Amachachu. And when I told people across the Transkei in the Eastern Cape area, Old Transkei, that I was working on the history of the Amachachu, they would say, "Who? The Amahu? We live here. We've never heard of the Amachachu." Uh-huh. So it is to admit that one has never heard of the Amachachu, you're in the company of the vast majority. And that is a measure of the success of George Cathcart's proclamation. He did get people to forget this history, this once very powerful group, the most powerful Xhosa speaking group, that's including Tembu and Xhosa groups northwest of the Great Kai, north of the Tormo River. Very powerful. The group that was in the teeth of conquest in the middle of the 19th century.
And of course, the reason why the Amachachu were essentially airbrushed out, although the people still existed, as you say, they were scattered, as you so correctly point out, is that they were so powerful and at times extremely resilient and resistant to the machinations of the colonialists in the Eastern Cape. And it's complex, isn't it? The British were kind of all over the place. I know I'm oversimplifying it, but they were pretty good at dividing and ruling, weren't they?
Yes. Now, this is a perfect instance of that. And of course, the roots of their success in the divide and rule is partly that the internal conflicts on this frontier, on this northwestern frontier, which, by the way, was a frontier for the Abatembu moving west and for the British moving east. So they come to clash in this area, is that there wasn't a unified front on the part of the Xhosa and the different Tembu groups. They were all jockeying for place and position too, And so the British used that to effect their own divide and rule strategy.
Now, what sets the Amachacho different from the Abatemba, Abatembu, Isixhosa? I mean, they all spoke the language, but they were different groups. How do we understand it? I mean, were they different in customs? Were they? How do we understand the fact that we get the House of Chacho and the House of Abatembu?
Okay. The way the house system works is that you have a genealogical line. So it's a very, very male driven line. So you have a genealogical line, and the Tembo all trace their ancestry from a single house, from the House of Dromo. And then you have the Great House and various minor houses. And the Great House, of course, is the offspring of the chief's great wife, not necessarily the first wife, but the wife who is chosen by the councillors as the great wife. Those, the offspring from that relationship, produce the great house, the great house, the heirs to the great house. Then there are various other houses, the right-hand house, and then there's various service houses, which go by different names, that are there to provide a male heir in the event of the direct heir being unfit, being killed, or there not being a male heir in that household. So then a child would be taken from one of the support houses into the great house. And the interesting thing about the right-hand house struggle, this is a side issue in a way, but it's only recent for the Amachacho, but it's there in a big way in some other groups, is that colonialism separated the houses geographically. So the great houses remained in the old Transkei area, far east as possible, whereas the right-hand houses looked for space to set up separate polities and moved west. So very often the right-hand houses were the ones who were in conflict with the colonizers rather than the great houses. And then the conflict is, well, who should we not separate? And that's where Matanzima was so expedient. He was from the right-hand house of the Abatembu and pushed for recognition of the right-hand house as equal to the great house. He manipulated the apartheid authorities to recognize him in that way. Now, the Chacho were not of the great house, but they were of an independent house, and they paid and showed allegiance to the great house throughout their history.
It really is fascinating, isn't it? And it's a story of, in a sense, of divorce from roots from 1852 until 2013. Now, there's also a story, isn't there, as to how the Chacho chieftaincy was reinstated?
Yes, you know, there is a sort of mantra that says the chieftaincy was so tainted by colonialism and apartheid, it is no longer a properly African institution. Now, we don't go with that argument. We recognize that the traces of colonialism are very present in the way the chieftaincy has been manipulated and indeed has had to play its game. But we recognize that chiefs play the game that is in front of them, and they are all constantly maneuvering around the complexities of colonial and apartheid administrations. Now, in 2013, when the Chacho chief is officially recognized for the very first time since 1835, they appeal to the Great House to install them, but the king of the Tembu was at that point on bail. He was facing charges of all kinds, including attempted murder, and he was a known addict of cannabis. And he didn't turn up to the installation. And the people who turned up were those bureaucratically trained under apartheid. In other words, the Matanzima family. And much to the distress of the Chachu chief, he was installed by one of the Matanzimas rather than the king, rather than the great house. He was installed by the right-hand house. And this was very distressing to him, and particularly to his late wife.
Yeah, it's sad, isn't it, that it sort of, it kind of ends this way, but it hasn't ended, has it? Because it's now 2018, and the Amachachu, like any indigenous group in South Africa, are facing lots of challenges for the future, not least of all the whole land question.
Yes. Yes, no, absolutely. Now, our view on the land question is informed by the evidence that we find in this research, that dispossession was not simply dispossession of land. That was the start. There was dispossession of land, but there was also dispossession of skills, dispossession of capacity to farm that land in terms of resources and capital and know-how. If you have 150 years, 200 years of migrant labor, people do not farm anymore, and they certainly don't farm in a modern kind of way. So we make the argument that certainly there is a shortage of land. Certainly people are desperate for land. Certainly people need to be given land, but they also need massive support in terms of how to farm that land. They need support around capital investment, support around technology, support around livestock husbandry, and so on. All of this is incredibly important, and we are very concerned that the debate around land seems to have got stuck on the issue of expropriation with or without compensation.
Yes, and
it doesn't go the next step.
Absolutely, there are far greater issues. Professor, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. I mean, how on earth can we encapsulate 256 pages in 18 minutes? Difficult, isn't it?
Yes, but thank you. That's great.
And of course, the book, The House of Chachu, Power, Politics and Chiefs, Northwest of the Great Kai River, circa 1818 to 2018, about a group of people that most of us never knew about, and at least now some more of our history, some of the dotted lines have been filled in. Professor Anne Kelk-Mager, one of the authors, and Pico Jeffrey Villelo, but Professor Mager online today. Thanks a lot for chatting to us, and everything of the best with the book.
Great. Thank you very much. Great pleasure.
Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge.